Chapter 4 of Green Grey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This Legamous recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. Next morning, perhaps about 10 o'clock, you were returning from the factory in the milk cart, sitting up singing and swaying with the motion of it, and light-hearted and hopeful among the jangling empty cans, and one that's full of whey. You'll drive in through the gate into the little grey homestead, as if it was the land of Canaan, and your eyes will fall on two startling figures coming across your pumpkin ground, carrying parcels and a basket, looking like two movie stars on location. There'll be big Nellie Ryan and little Katie Ryan, and Mrs. Ryan won't be with them at all. "Ghost," you'll mumble, turning a bit pale. "They meant to come all right." And then you'll fold up. On the way to the piggery, where you'll deliver the can of whey to a family of expectant, squeaking swine, you'll be blessing yourself again for going near old Tim Ryan, and getting into all this woman's business. But it can't be helped now, and as big Nellie and little Katie approach the house, you'll be taking the horse out and fumbling the harness. Rover will be barking hard, too, making out their enemies, and that he's got a stiff job on, though he knows them as well as he knows you. And looking across the Ryan's homestead, Tuam, they call it, you'll see Mrs. Ryan watching from the veranda to see how the girls get on. Of course, you'll have to go round to the front of your quarters to meet them, and when you're nearly there, you'll order Rover to go and lie down and ask him what he thinks he's barking at. You do this to keep cool and collected. A little nearer, and you'll grin and say, "Hello, you think he was going to eat you?" And big Nellie will smile, and dragging the sides of her hat down over her cheeks, will tell you they've come over to tidy up the place for you, if you'll just show them the run of it, and where the things are they've to take back. You'll stammer and blush, and be sorry for all the jolly trouble they're going to for nothing. And Nellie will say, "Oh, no," while Katie will screw up her nose and look about. "There it is, that's it," and you'll open the door to them. "But you won't want me any longer." And off you'll bolt, before big Nellie can fix her smile on you again, or little Katie stretch her neck far enough to see all that's inside. They'll throw the windows open, and put something against the door to keep it from closing. Then stare hard at your housekeeping and your furniture for a minute or so, as if they'd come to learn something new. But soon big Nellie will have her cape off, and an apron on, and be hard at work in the kitchen. And while she's firing the stove and getting hot water ready, and clearing your shelves of dishes and things, little Katie, who is a girl of 12 or 13 and just coming on, will tiptoe to the door of your bedroom and peep in, as though she suspected someone was in hiding or in bed there. When no one jumps up or sings out to her, she'll go right in and look around at the little that's there, and handle whatever is on the table. Your brush and comb she'll drop and pull faces at, as if they harboured plague, but your silver watch she'll open and fool with, and put to her ear, and wind up. There'll be a letter of 5 or 6 pages, kept from flying away by your murky little mirror, which serves as a paperweight. It's a letter from Sarah McCleverty to Bill Baker, which was dropped along the factory road by Bill for you to find. You hadn't read it all yet, because you haven't had time, and you know it's Bill Baker's letter by the envelope, which you used soon as you got home to light the fire with. Your sweetheart, Sarah, told you near enough who the author of it was, and you'll be going to restore it to Bill next time you meet him. Little Katie will see that letter, and wonder what you've stood the mirror on it for. Girls, like grown-ups, always like to see things kept in their proper places. That's the difference between them and men. So while she's looking at herself in the glass, and smiling different ways to see which of them suits her best, her hand will be fondling the letter as if it was a doll. Deciding on one of the smiles is the best for her complexion, she takes more interest in the letter. The first 2 words of it, "My lovest," will hold her, and she'll open her eyes, and the smile will be forgotten. Then she'll rush to the last page, and when she reads, "Your sweetheart, Sarah," you can tell she's found a great gold mine. She'll turn back quick to the beginning, and when she's taken in the first few lines, there'll be a broad grin on her face. But she's pretty careful of her step, as little Katie. So she'll put the letter down and run to the front door to see where you are, and what kind of work you're setting yourself. She'll see you hooking the horses to the plough. Then, taking the broom, she'll tell big Nellie, who's turning the kitchen inside out and decorating the shelves with nicked paper, and looking as pleased as though you had just brought her into it as your bride, that she'll give the rooms a sweep over, and off back little Katie will skip to your bedroom and to Baker's love letter. She'll sit on your bunk with it, and hold the broom between her knees so as to be ready for work at the sound of someone coming. She isn't a rapid reader of love letters, not having had much practice as yet, and Sarah McCleverty doesn't write copperplate, or spell according to the dictionary or the local schoolmaster. But she's worrying through it all right, smiling and gaping, and getting red sometimes, and excited looking at others, then putting it down sudden, but without losing the place, and slipping to the door again, she'll see how you're getting on with your job. A word or two more with Nellie, then making a flourish on the floor with the broom, back she'll creep to Sarah and Bill again. Though some of it will seem to be shocking to her, little Katie will want to read every word of that letter. Meantime, you'll be ploughing away up and down, singing out to the horses to make yourself more important because you think someone's listening, and stopping always at the headland nearest to the house to clean the plough. And when you've cleaned it, you'll be keeping an eye on the house, and you'll see homely-looking smoke coming out of the chimney, and Big Nellie coming out of the house with papers and rags and all kinds of rubbish to burn. And sometimes she'll be getting water out of the tank, or throwing some out of a dish, and looking up at you as she throws it. And seeing the smoke, and her moving about and looking across at you, will make the little homestead seem a different place, and you'll begin to feel what it must be like to fellows who have their own wives on theirs. You'll notice, too, that Big Nellie is a fine stamp of a woman, and that she's smarter on her feet. You'll be taking longer and longer after each round to clean the plough, too, and when little Katie leaves the house and comes running across to the fence calling out, "Nellie says, will you come and have a cup of tea now, Mr. Gall?" your heart'll give a jump. "Hokey! Tea?" he'll echo, as if you didn't quite understand. "It's all waiting on the table!" And back will fly the busy little Katie. "Cripes," you'll mutter, and leaving the horses standing there, they would stand there all day if you asked them to, you'll rub the soil off your hands onto your trousers, and rake your moist hair with your fingers, and creep cautiously through the fence. You'll drag a fistful of leaves from a gum bush as you saunter across the green patch to the house, and be crunching them as you wonder what to say when you go in. Big Nellie meeting you at the door with real mountain bloom on her cheeks, will invite you to, "Come along, Mr. Gall, before your tea gets cold." Angels of light, you were never met at your own door like this before. But somehow you feel it's her door, and you're a visitor being welcomed. Cripes, though, when you come in and look round you hardly recognise it. It's undergone a metamorphosis. You look down on the floor, but don't like walking on it with your dusty, milk-stained bluchers. And the side of the table! At one end of it is spread a white linen cloth, wherever it came from, ironed like a dress shirt, and on it, set in fashion, are the teapot, a cup and saucer, the sugar basin with a spoon in it, a big bowl of butter that's not yours, a plate of scones, a bottle of homemade melon jam that isn't yours either, the milk jug all brightened up, and a serviette, wherever it also came from. At the other end will be a big bunch of flowers leaning over and ducking their heads about. Heavens! You feel it's your wedding breakfast you're sitting down to without the parson or best man, and you don't seem to know where the chair is when you're going to sit. "Do you like milk and sugar in your tea, Mr. Gall?" And Nellie, while you'll be nodding you do because you can't find your voice, will start pouring you out a cup and calling to little Katie to see that the cake in the oven doesn't burn, like a good girl. Your cloudy, milk-splashed shirt and pants and dusty brown arms don't silhouette well against the white linen tablecloth and bright tea-things, and the comparison will make you uncomfortable in your own home. You nearly spill the tea over it in consequence. Then, when you lift your cup with precaution, you get a nervous attack, and the cup stops halfway up like a hotel lift and wobbles in your hand. My! How you'll put it down, quick, and reach for the scones to kill time with. That'll be till Big Nellie makes herself scarce. But when she suddenly runs out to the kitchen to take the cake out of the oven, that little Katie, who has found a Jew's harp, doesn't know is burning like Rome was when Nero was fiddling, you'll hurl that cup of tea down like beer, and send a scone or two and most of the butter after it. In a minute or two more you'll be getting composed and feel a bit at home. You'll lean back in the chair and look out to see if the horses are standing all right. Of course you know they'll be half asleep, and that no one but yourself, or someone shaking a feed of corn at their heads, could awaken them. You have drunk all the tea, but you sit there wondering if Big Nelly will come in again before you go out. You feel you would like to have a wise conversation with her. She doesn't seem to be coming, so you'll start to go. But when you make a noise getting up, she'll come hurrying in, apologizing, and asking would you have liked another cup of tea. Laws! How you'll wish you could reel off compliments like the goofy city swanks who charm the women on steamers and in tea-shops. But you only shake your head and smile and twirl your old hat and tell her you must be getting over to the plough again now. "My word, you're getting on with it. You'll soon have all that paddock finished, won't you?" she'll say. And the way she'll say it will burn your ears, and the skin on your face will shine like Moses did when he came down off Mount Sinai after the big interview. "If I only had someone always here to do the housekeeping for me," he'll say, laughing amiably, and backing to the door, "I could do a lot more, and better, don't you think so?" "A good many of them don't, though." And Big Nelly, who will know what you're hinting at, will also know that some family men do a lot of ploughing inside, beside the kitchen fire. "I wouldn't be one of them sort." And you'll step out and be off smiling, and reckoning you got in a good word for yourself anyway. When you start to plough again, you'll talk like a brother to the horses, and feel as if you're cultivating the Garden of Eden. More and more you will keep your eyes on the home, and when little Katie issues from it to empty a dish or something, you'll wave to her like a brother-in-law, and she'll shake the dish at you like a relation. Meanwhile, Big Nelly, having done all she can see to do in the kitchen and living room, will turn her energies to your bedroom. And while she's hanging things up on nails, and making your bed, and wondering if you wear pyjamas, and where they can be, little Katie will be hovering about, watching to see if she'll observe Baker's love letter, which she takes for granted was written to you. But Big Nelly, who isn't there to pry into your correspondence, passes it over, as a matter of respect, and little Katie will get restless, and point to it, and pull inviting little faces. "A letter from some of his people, I suppose," Big Nelly will observe at last, but giving attention to the arranging of some red roses on your table. But little Katie won't be satisfied. She must have Big Nelly read that letter somehow or other, without giving herself away. "It starts with 'my lovest,'" and little Katie will start humming a tune. "With what?" And suddenly evincing some interest, Big Nelly will glance at the love letter. "And it looks like Sarah McCleverty's writing, too," little Katie will pause to add, and then go on humming more. Big Nelly's face will flush, and she'll look closer at the epistle, and little Katie, pleased with herself, will run out to the door to see if you're sticking well to your work, and to give her sister a good chance to enjoy the letter as she did herself. You'll be scraping mud from the mould-board when she looks out, and you'll wave to her when you're putting the scraper back in its place, and she'll wave to you, and for Big Nelly's benefit she'll remain a while, waving more. And Big Nelly, who also will conclude, without evidence to the contrary, that the letter was written to you, will be rushing her eyes over its pages like wireless, and with blood mounting to her cheeks and fire flying from her eyes. But she'll drop it like poison when she hears little Katie coming in again, and start cleaning the mirror and striving to appear disinterested. But little Katie will know a lot, too. "What's in it? Is it from Sarah McCleverty?" she'll want to know, looking innocent and anxious, and breathing short. "Do you think I would read Mr. Gall's letters, or anyone's, you silly girl?" Nelly will choke, hardly knowing what to do about it. She'll be disappointed in you, and hateful of the McCleverty girl. "Oh, you have! That's not how it was!" And lifting one of the displaced sheets, little Katie will start perusing it, boldly. "Don't you? What if Mr. Gall was to come in?" And Nelly will take it from her. "Run out and see if the towel I hung on the line is dry, and bring me the broom." And little Katie will fly off faster than ever, but only because she wants Big Nelly to finish the letter, so that she can talk to her about it on equal terms, and without being accused of wrongdoing. And she knows, from what's in it, that Big Nelly will be bursting to read it all. Women are curious like that. But this time little Katie will stay out much longer, and be waving the towel to you, and when she's going inside again, she'll sneak on tiptoe and catch Nellie glaring in hate at the last lines and clenching her teeth. "Oh, you've read it!" she'll shout, pouncing on her triumphantly, and then, "I know what's in it. It's from S.M., who I said, isn't it?" Big Nellie won't say anything. She'll be confounded. "And there's a lot of bad things in it, isn't there?" Then Big Nellie will put the letter under the mirror again and say, "Get our basket, Katie," and will take back the jam and scones and everything we brought. He can bring his washing over to Mother himself if he likes. Come away out, and don't do any more for him. Boo! Don't let his old dog touch you." And out they go. Crossing the paddock, they'll be holding their heads down and keeping a deaf ear, and when you wave and call out to them, "So long, are you going?" they won't see or hear you. Little Katie would like to look at you, though, and give you a smile, too, but Big Nellie will be telling her not to. And so you'll stare after them, and think and puzzle, but you can't make it out. End of chapter 4.